This is The Source on KSTX, 89.1 FM, a product of the Texas Public Radio Newsroom. I'm David Martin Davies. A United States-led attack on Syria could be hours away. It would be a retaliation strike against the Assad government, which is suspected of launching a deadly chemical weapons attack on a neighborhood outside of Damascus. That attack left over 1,000 dead, including women and children. Right now in Damascus, the capital of Syria, people are fleeing the city in anticipation of Tomahawk missile strikes coming from U.S. warships. The civil war in the Middle East, Eastern nation is ratcheting up. Already over 100,000 people have been killed in the fighting. Rebels are seeking to overthrow the brutal regime, but it's unknown what kind of government the rebels would install if they win. And after the American retaliation strike, what will Syria do? What will China and Russia do? They were the allies of Syria. So what caused the Syrian civil war? What might the future hold for the Syrian people? We'll talk this hour with David W. Lesh. He is the professor of Middle Eastern History at the Trinity University. He just published a new and updated version of his book, Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad. Welcome to The Source, David.
Pleasure to be here.
And we welcome your phone calls. If you've got questions or comments about what's happening in Syria right now, the number is 614-8980, 614-8980. So, David, you interviewed Assad himself, and what was he like, President Bashar al-Assad?
Well, in the beginning, the first time I met him, I joked with him that, Mr. President, you made one big mistake when you came to power in 2000 upon the death of his father. And he said, what was that? And I said, you made it be known that you like Phil Collins' music, the British rocker. And he kind of looked at me strangely, of course, and he asked, why is that? And I said, because it fed into this emerging profile that you are this pro-Western modernizer who's going to reform Syria overnight, because he's something of a computer nerd, likes the technological toys of the West, studied 18 months of advanced ophthalmology in London. He is a licensed ophthalmologist, so he was atypical type of, Middle East leader. And the problem was this raised a lot of expectations. He was interested in certain levels of reform, but the Syrian system is immune to dramatic reform. It can only do so at best in an incremental fashion. And at first, I think, he wanted to be something of the reformer. There was a great deal of hope in him because he was the atypical type of Middle East leader, because he brought in people into government who were academics, who were technocrats, and not the traditional military security types that tend to infest many of these authoritarian regimes in the Middle East. The problem was, I think, that, as the old adage goes, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I saw this over the years in meeting him, that he became much more comfortable in power, which is not a bad thing. But when it's an authoritarian regime and an authoritarian leader, that means he's much more comfortable being that type of leader and perpetuating and sustaining that type of authoritarian system rather than changing it.
Now, he inherited the job as president, which is is he really a president? Was he elected? He's more or less the dictator. He inherited it from his father. And what was his father like?
Well, his father was very taciturn. Bashar is different in many ways. He's much more gregarious. But one of the things that his father did and what he brought to Syria was this Faustian bargain that he would provide stability, something that Syria had experienced very little of since its independence in 1946, with continuous coups and attempted coups. And so when the father came to power in 1970, he said, I will bring you security, stability, maybe even some economic prosperity at times, but in essence, you must give up a great deal of political freedoms. There's going to be one dominant political party, the Ba'ath Party. Because this is a dangerous neighborhood, we need an extensive, omnipresent military security apparatus. And so the Syrian people generally speaking, accepted this trade-off, with some important exceptions. And so when Bashar, came to power in 2000, very much he inherited it, although, he and the Syrian elite will say that he was elected and the institutions worked and all of that sort of stuff. But he inherited this system. And, of course, he inherited the mandate of trying to provide stability. And that's something that, he no longer can provide, and as has been shown over the last 2.5 years. there is a great deal of instability in Syria due to the uprising and conflict.
Now, his mother is still alive?
Yes, his mother's still alive, and according to reports, she's no longer in the country. She's elsewhere in the Middle East.
But hasn't she been advising him to be tough?
Yeah, there are different stories on that. I think her influence is definitely felt. Every Friday, certainly, you know, during early on in his presidency, the family had dinner, and she used to live in the same building as Bashar and his wife and children. So just, you know, propinquity would give her some influence. And Bashar's wife, Asma al-Assad, had told me on several occasions that she provided something of a model for, you know, being a first lady, although Asma al-Assad was much more out in front and in public view than Bashar's mother was. So there's different views on that right now. But I think right now, you know, he's his own man. That's one of the things that I think I noticed is, you know, in growing comfortable with power, he grew into his own man, for better or worse. He's responsible and he's in control of what's been going on.
But it is interesting that, I mean, he was not supposed to be the president. He had an older brother who died in a car accident, and that he had trained to be an ophthalmologist and was very much a person who was, you know, ready not to be the president.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he was the reluctant president. I wrote in an earlier book, The New Line of Damascus, that, you know, he's akin to Michael Corleone. When Michael was the reluctant godfather, and he wasn't supposed to inherit it. And when he finally did, he promised to make the family business legitimate. You know?
After Sonny got whacked.
After Sonny got whacked, after his older brother died. Yeah, almost very similar. And, of course, many people have compared the Assad regime to a mafia type of thing. It's much more complicated than this, but some of the comparisons are striking. So he was not, you know, earmarked for this, and there he was groomed, and he was brought back to Syria from London upon the death of his brother in 1994, and quickly elevated in the state apparatus, in the military, political, even social apparatus. He became chairman of the Syrian Computer Society. He got control of the Lebanese file, which was, you know, one of the most important in Syrian foreign policy. So he was elevated quickly, and there seemed to be a race against time because his father was in ill health to build a support base around him and to give him enough legitimacy so that he could take over when the father died. And it seemed that it was barely in enough time.
It's interesting that you portray him as his computer nerd, and we've seen these Syrian electronic attacks on the New York Times and other media portals recently. So certainly there is a lot of savvy in that regime about using hackers.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess they're a product of his own background and emphasis in Syria.
Okay, well, we are talking about what's happening in Syria right now. Of course, you're probably aware that the United States is inching towards some sort of retaliation attack for what is a suspected Syrian-authorized chemical attack on a neighborhood outside of Damascus. We're talking with David W. Lesh. He's a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University. We're going to dive in a little more on this topic. We do want to hear your phone calls. Call in 614-8980. This is The Source on KSTX. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. We're talking about Assad and what's happening in Syria. The United States is expected to launch an attack on Syria of some sort. Every time the United States launches missiles at a country, we should know about that country. We have an expert with us, David W. Lish. He's written the book, Syria and the Fall of the House of Assad. And so what has been the United States' relationship with Syria over the years?
It's been very mercurial. There was, again, some hope, as many people had when Assad came to power in 2000, that a productive relationship could develop, and perhaps out of that, the momentum from the 90s in terms of hope for a Syrian-Israeli peace agreement could emerge. But with the U.S. after 9/11, and particularly with the U.S. invasion of Iraq, which the Syrian regime opposed, relations started to quickly deteriorate, and very much deteriorated after Syria was held responsible, legitimate or not, for the assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri in February 2005, and was isolated And one of the things that that occurred is that Assad emerged, you know, from this isolation and tremendous international pressure to be kind of welcomed back into the international, you know, community. And he was traveling around and improving relations with former enemies, and including the United States. In fact, you know, in December 2010, just a few months before the uprising broke out, in March 2011, you know, he and his wife were traveling around Paris and being feted by French elite society.
Okay, let's go to the phones. The number is 614-8980. If you've got a question or a comment, we'd want to hear from you. Marlon is on the line. Marlon, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. Well, what I'm understanding from all the news and TV and radios are like the people from Syria are fighting with their own government, but that's not the case. The case is all the Salafis, all the Wahhabis, paid by Qatar, paid by Saudi Arabia, paid by Tunis and Turkey, they are coming with the weapon from USA, with the weapon from Saudi Arabia. Even they are using from Israel's tanks and Israel's, cars to come and fight with the people in Syria. And the people in Syria, people are, you know, desperate for help. And they use the weapon, they use all these chemical weapons, killing and trying to get everybody involved to get rid of Assad, which is a dream of the most of the neighbor countries, including Yemen, Jordan.
Okay, Marlon, thank you for the call. Let's address some of those issues. The fighters, are they foreign fighters coming from across the world for jihad?
Some of them are. And that's one of the problems in Syria is that it's become a proxy battleground at the regional and international levels. The regional level, as the caller said, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and some others on one side, and supported by the West, the United States, and the Syrian government, Iran, Hezbollah, portions of Iraq, and Russia, and a little bit of China on the other side. And so this has greatly complicated the issue, and you have these arms and money funneling in from all these different sources that in many ways has fragmented the opposition. One of the reasons I think, you know, when we strike, and I think we will strike sooner or later, is one of the reasons it'll be a limited, calibrated strike is that we really don't, in my view, really don't want the precipitous fall of the regime, of the Syrian government, because we're afraid of the chaos that might ensue, because the opposition is so fragmented, because there are, you know, al-Qaeda elements, jihadist elements, although the minority, but they are disproportionately important militarily because of their military prowess. And so, you know, until there is a more unified, in the U.S. view, a unified representative opposition, we want this resolved through some sort of political settlement, not with the sudden collapse of the regime that will create this free-for-all vacuum that will just cause Syria to implode and could cross borders in Lebanon and Jordan, even Israel, Turkey, Iraq, even more so than it already has.
Yeah, everyone keeps talking about these unintended consequences. If you go in, who knows what will happen? It's and what do you want to achieve? Is that even achievable? Very difficult to figure that out.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think from the U.S. perspective, this is more punishment rather than intervention. We're not the Obama administration has come out plainly and said we're not doing this for regime change. It's going to be a change of behavior on the part of the regime in terms of their use of chemical weapons. Practically speaking, if when we strike, it will have no real bearing on what's going on the ground. And I don't think the Syrian regime will react in any sort of way. They've been hit by the Israelis. The U.S. has crossed their borders during the Iraq war, and the Syrians have done very little in response. They don't want to widen this. They don't have the capabilities nor the interest in widening this conflict any more than it already is.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. John is on the line. John, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you. My question for your guest is, how much control does Assad actually have over the military? Syria, of course, has more of a Soviet-style military where a lot of the leadership is and the authorities are a lot more decentralized than we have in the United States, where generals have a lot of ability to act on their own. So is he really in control, and could this potential chemical attack be more of a rogue-type thing that has a lot more to do with some of the personal and cultural interactions there than the actual policy of the regime?
All right. Thank you for the call, John. So the military there could be kind of like the way the military is set up in Pakistan or in Egypt, kind of a separate body?
No, I mean, the military is very tightly organized and controlled in Syria. I find it inconceivable that if the Syrian regime authorized this chemical attack that occurred last week, that Bashar al-Assad didn't know about it. He's very much in control. He's very much involved in the day-to-day military affairs. Some of the telephone traffic that the NSA has picked up apparently refers to a panicky call from a Syrian defense ministry official to some of the people on the front line who apparently were at the scene of the chemical attack, which may suggest that perhaps there was miscommunication in terms of the amount of chemical weapons used or how they would be used. But in general terms, the Syrian's government, the Syrian military, I've heard from a number of sources, has definite control over the chemical stocks. And if they are being used, they are being used at the discretion of the government.
Well, Syria has a large weapons cache of chemical weapons. Mm-hmm. And also, what would be their motivation for doing that chemical strike?
It's hard to fathom. It doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense because you had UN investigators investigating prior incidents of alleged chemical attacks who were in Damascus, only a few miles away from the site. It's very hard to fathom, and especially those of us in the West, the United States, I always say try to put yourself in the position of Damascus. You know, try to understand their own conceptual paradigm. You know, from their world, you know, they see everything as in a very restricted fashion, in the sense that they believe almost the whole world is against them. The only military rationale I can come up with that makes any sense is that you know, they're wanting to clear out rebel areas, or you know, what they call rebels or revolutionary areas in the outskirts of the city. And although Syrian government has the preponderance of military force, you know, they have a finite amount of military troops, of soldiers themselves who've been on the front lines for almost 2.5 years. You know, perhaps to try to preserve resources, one way to clear out or to thwart what was suspected to be a rebel or opposition offensive into Damascus. Maybe they thought chemical weapons was the best way to do it, and they thought, you know, they could get away with it. And obviously, if that's the case, they did not.
And some people say that, I mean, in the Syrian government saying this, that rebels did the attack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I doubt that very much. The sources I've consulted at very high levels in intelligence in other countries that are very much closer to Syria than the United States is, they are certain that the Syrian government has absolute control over the chemical weapon stocks. And they doubt that the Syrian rebels have developed chemical weapons, certainly in the amount that seems to have been used in this attack.
Back to the phones. Ryan is on the line. Ryan, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. First, I kind of changed my question. You addressed my previous question. I'm unclear on why your guest thinks that it's unlikely that the rebels attacked using chemical weapons, when just last week it was shown that they did use the sarin gas. So that's my first question, and it seems to me that we really need proof before we do something akin to what we did with Iraq. We must know for certain, because Assad will strike back. He's not going to just roll over. So what is our objective? Thank you for taking my call.
All right, thanks, Ryan.
No, I agree wholeheartedly that we need more proof. I'm hoping that the Obama administration waits until the UN inspectors come back and give their initial report, because it would be very embarrassing once again, as the caller pointed out, from the Iraqi situation, to launch an attack and yet to find out from the UN investigators that they have inconclusive evidence that it was a chemical weapons attack. Now, that's all they're charged at finding. Their charge is not to determine who launched the attack. And again, I'm not a chemical weapons expert, but I'm relaying everything I've heard and read and from people in the region. That the rebels were very unlikely, if not impossible, to carry this type of a level of a chemical weapons attack. I do disagree with the caller, though. As I said earlier, based on prior occasions and a mountain of evidence, I don't think Assad, should there be an attack, will strike back in any significant way. It would be totally counterproductive. And he hasn't done so in the past to Israeli strikes and U.S. incursions during the Iraq War.
But they are close to Russia and China, and that they have been their protectors on the U.N. Security Council. But you don't put odds very high that this is going to become World War III.
Not immediately. I mean, but that's the problem. When you launch weapons, you engage in a way you hadn't before. You are involved militarily, whether you like it or not. And in some notable prior cases in the Middle East, particularly with Iraq in the 1990s, when we launched cruise missiles, we eventually went to war with Iraq. So just launching cruise missiles for the sake of maintaining your credibility or even punishment, it should be accompanied by strategic objectives and overall strategy, and I think that's lacking currently.
And so usually what happens is when the United States launches the missiles, and then we see the videotape of it, of the missiles having hit like the baby formula factory or something like that, and is that what we should expect next?
Well, I mean, these are fairly precise, but we have assets in the region who have already selected probably command and control structures that will be hit should an attack occur. But I'm sure that the Syrian government and its allies, the Russians, the Iranians,
Hezbollah
will make full propaganda use of this and try to turn, you know, a civil war and build up into a resistance against the West and Israel.
All right, David W. Lesh, he's a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University. He has interviewed Assad. He's written the book Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad, a new and updated version of the book out now. We thank you for coming in and giving us an update and background on Syria. As we said, if the United States is getting ready to go in conflict with the nation, we need to know more about that nation and look at that, what's happening next. And when we come back from the break, we're going to be talking about the big science fiction convention that is in San Antonio. It's the world's biggest one. You don't want to miss out on that. How did science fiction impact you? This is The Source on KSTX.